This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Chris Buckley. How are you, Chris?
Good, thank you.
Excellent. You're one of the top viticulturists at Vineworks. What's your exact role?
Business director.
Business director. Sounds very important.
Sort of. I work with James, the CEO, on the kind of day-to-day kind of runnings of the business at Vineworks.
And you're a trained viticulturalist?
Yes.
Yep. And you spend a lot of time, your main role is setting up new vineyards, isn't it?
It's kind of the full package, really. We do everything from pre-establishment all the way through to growing and managing, harvesting, and we have a kind of a large kind of retail web shop operation, which helps kind of support all those functions, selling materials and sundries that people will need kind of throughout the season.
Last week, we were talking about the UK industry, and we were talking about how you're seeing your clients change from being sort of individuals with lots of money setting up their own winery doing it, and then you said that you're seeing more arable farmers coming in using viticulture as a diversification to manage their portfolio, if you like, of land. I'm really interested in sort of exploring a little bit more about the UK viticultural scene at the moment. And apart from the sort of change in climates where you're seeing farmers coming in now, which I think is a really good sign because it means that there's profit there and they've gone, okay, we are now going to enter it, rather than in the old days, 20, 30 years ago, the retired army general who put a couple of vines in the ground, didn't really know what he was doing, and he was just doing it because he's passionate about wine. But now you're seeing it more as a commercial business for farmers.
Yeah.
What other trends are you starting to see in the industry?
I think the biggest trend is probably, it's a bit more of a sort of cerebral kind of one, really. It's around kind of knowledge and sort of professionalism. I mean, in my kind of 12, 15 years I've been involved in the kind of UK viticulture, it's changed kind of vastly in terms of our kind of base knowledge of what works here, how we grow it, and then kind of moving on, how we kind of vinify it.
I always think one of the key things has been Plumpton, actually, strangely enough, because that training people to know not to make faults is a skill in its own right, you know. And I think before Plumpton got in there, the skill sets weren't really that deep. Whereas now, you know, one of my team members who's running tastings, he's a trained oenologist, winemaker. He's not doing that. He's not gone down that path. Yeah. But what you're seeing is it's just a depth of knowledge now.
I think so. I completely agree. The time that I've been involved in the UK viticulture, it's changed kind of exponentially, really. And that level of sort of professionalism and knowledge base has just grown and grown and grown. Plumpton has done a fantastic job in developing a course and a curriculum that's helped kind of support the growth of the industry. And like you say, purely with the number of, kind of candidates leaving each year, armed with degrees and our master's degrees, I think it's really helped kind of propel the quality level of what's being produced and the consistency as well, really. Given the challenges we have with weather, it's a real battle to be able to kind of achieve that kind of consistency kind of year on year, really. The other thing would be not only the knowledge, but the level of professionalism. So that's obviously vineyards and, appointing, professional, qualified people to run them. And then the kind of plethora of support companies and support, kind of businesses that have sort of sprung up around the industry has helped grow, really.
Yeah.
All these things, that weren't there kind of 10, 15, sort of 20 years ago, even. It's kind of massively changed. I mean, in comparison, going back even further than that, really was a kind of a cottage industry, 30, 40 years ago. Mm. We've kind of mainly Germanic kind of varieties planted very kind of sporadically around the UK, whereas now we've got much more commercially driven varietal choices in vineyards that are specifically laid out for commercial production. Rows, sort of sensible spacings and trellis sort of systems, really, to support things like mechanisation and optimising fruit production.
What sort of trends are you seeing in terms of planting? Is it, because everybody talks about sparkling wine, but it's not just sparkling wine.
That's been the driver over the past past 20 years, and it's been a huge success. If you look at the quality level that's been produced and what's gone to market and been revered by critics and consumers alike, really, it's really what's driven that market is the kind of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Meunier. But I suppose on the back of that, it can't always be sparkling at pretty high sort of price point. You know, there will be other things that come on the back of that. And certainly in the past 10 years, we've seen the growth of still wine plantings as well. Bacchus being the big one, but an awful lot of Pinot Gris and kind of early ripening clones of Pinot Noir for still wine production. And this gives, I guess, the consumer, maybe never experienced English or Welsh wine before, a cheaper or an entry level kind of step in, really, with something that's maybe a bit more familiar.
I'm surprised you mentioned Pinot Gris. I've seen Pinot Gris about, but not a lot. I would never have said, "Oh, that's a grape for the future." Are you saying you'll put a decent amount in?
We've put lots in. Lots of producers that are kind of using it, maybe particularly in a blend or as a standalone wine. But we look after a lot of hectarage of Pinot Gris, a little bit of Pinot Blanc, and then some sort of still clones of Pinot Noir.
And is it being used for still production, Pinot Gris?
It can go to either sparkling or still. But some of the still wines or some of the still fruit that we've kind of helped grown and deliver to wineries in pretty good quality.
Okay. You didn't mention Chardonnay there as a still wine. And I've had, I was Simpson's Estate. They've got it's Roman Road Chardonnay, I think it was.
Yes.
I was blown away by that during COVID when I first tasted that. And it was a good vintage they had, but it was really, really good. And they'd got it just enough oak in there. And it was like a lightweight Meursault, I thought I put it down to.
No, absolutely. My bad. I should have mentioned Chardonnay. But yeah, no, absolutely. It's, there's plenty of, like you mentioned, Simpsons that do it kind of very, very well.
Yeah.
In certain areas and certain vineyards, there's the scope to produce some sort of fantastic Chardonnay.
Is there much Piwi grapes going in? The Piwi are those sort of new age hybrids that are quite resistant.
Yeah. I mean, historically we had kind of things like kind of Regent and Rondo. That was the kind of the first iteration, I suppose, of kind of Piwi varieties. But the past sort of 20 odd years, there's been quite a lot of development that's gone on in particularly Germany with Volker Freitag, one of the nurserymen in the Alps, and also in Switzerland as well. And they, the breeding process for creating new varieties is a very long-term sort of program, really.
We did a 5-podcast season.
Yeah.
The whole process with Sam Doncaster, and he took us through the whole process of breeding it. But are you seeing, like, there's some, I've had some nice reds now. I've had a couple of English reds that I went, actually, this is pretty good. I mean, I'm not a big fan of English Pinot Noir. I think it's just, why bother when you can have a New Zealand Pinot that's so much better and cheaper. But some of these reds are, you know, they're starting to come with a little bit of guts and everything in them.
Yeah, I think, and Piwis will certainly kind of help lead that way. Like saying, compared to the previous iteration, this kind of new round, obviously they need to keep that sort of disease-resistant, sort of grower-friendly ability. But this time they're kind of being bred in order to kind of pack a punch and to deliver on flavour. Really. So I completely agree. There's they'll have their kind of place in either a standalone wines, but also, you know, helping in blends to bolster.
Is there any particular Piwi grapes that you've seen going in a bit more than others?
Well, Divico is the one that we've put a lot of that in, Cabaret Noir. Is the other, and Pinotin those are the three reds that we've probably done the most. There's a few others.
When you say you've put a lot in, is it going to be something in the next few years you're going to see materially turning up quite a lot, or is it it's still just a little spicy flavour in the back?
I think in comparison to what's planted, it's a very small percentage, but will most likely make a lot of noise.
Yeah,
I think the reality is it's going to be scores of hectares, but I think the quality level that will hopefully come out of once these vines come to fruition will kind of make a lot of noise.
Divico in particular, I've had some ones I've had some ones I've been quite excited about. What do you think the biggest challenges are at the moment for UK producers or growers? Not producers, I don't care about the winemaker.
No. Well, I think the two things, the number one's the weather. Yeah, there's not a lot we can do about it. Yeah, it's kind of the bane of our lives, really. And the kind of number two is the finances, I think. Farming's, it's always tough. Mm-hmm. It's constantly evolving. The cost of production is always a bit like the weather. It's a constant wrestle from year to year, really. So helping our kind of clients in to kind of manage that cost base and to get through on time and on budget during the grey season is a big challenge.
The thing with it, though, is that you're always going to be up. Farmers are normally price takers, not price makers. So they're always going to get squeezed on price. It's just the nature of the business. You know, there's a lot of farmers and a small number of buyers. So the small number of buyers have market power over the large farmers. Yeah. So the farmers are always going to be pushed on margin.
Yeah.
Unless they can create their own brand or something like that.
I completely agree.
If you're a contract grower, you're going to get push. Although it's like anything, when there's a grape shortage and you're a contract grower, you make money.
Or you don't, because you're in that contract and you're the one that year who wants to be out of contract that's coming to the open market going, hey guys, I've got this, that and the other.
Yeah.
Kind of my experience is that, you know, a lot of the producers within the industry are fairly, it's not like, you know, a big supermarket dealing with a dairy farmer. A lot of the producers, I feel, are pretty fair in terms of, you know, when they're dealings with growers and setting fair and long-term, you know, kind of plans and contracts. I mean, mm-hmm. equally, they don't want them, the producer doesn't want the grower to fail because, you know, that's their supply, it's their, it's their product that they need in order to vinify a bottle and ultimately sell on, really. Whilst there's lots of plantings kind of going on, there's not necessarily someone kind of immediately ready to step up to kind of fill that void of the grower. So it's kind of a balance, really, in, you know, kind of achieving a fair price that means it works for the grower and the supplier, but also continue to supply for the producer, but without compromising too much on their kind of cost base.
What do you think the opportunities are in the UK for the next 5 to 10 years, looking at it from a viticulturalist point of view?
I think, well, we talked about peewees. I think it'd be absolutely great if that made more headway. I think in terms of growing, they're a much more of a user friendly sort of variety, but with potential for making, you know, really good quality still wines that will offer something different, I suppose, on the market to sparkling, and from a cash flow perspective as well. Selling, you know, still wines, you're looking at getting that money back into the business within 6, 12 months, rather than the kind of
two, three years
at least for sort of sparkling. I think just the general growth in still wines in general, that's a trend that will continue really. Mm-hmm. And lastly, the other kind of trend that I think we'll see is a lot more kind of mechanization and use of robotics in what will become available. We already have driverless tractors in the market, and kind of see a future where, you know, things will be a lot more kind of linked up from a kind of mechanical point of view, really.
Yep. One of the problems with that, though, is not really a problem, but if the cost of running a tractor gets cheaper, I was watching something, I shouldn't really say this, but Jane and I quite like Clarkson's Farm. It's quite
me too.
Funny.
Yeah, it's great.
It's funny. I'm not a big Clarkson fan usually, but I do I like that. And I remember they had a consultant come in, and he was sitting there with his tractor, and Caleb was sitting there, and I think it was basically sort of long, the consultant was sitting there and his tractor was running while they were chatting, and Caleb was like, there's just money, because
it's dripping away.
It's just dripping away. And the problem is if operating a tractor gets cheaper because you haven't got an operator or whatever it is, then you might be tempted to use it, and then you get other issues associated with soil compaction and all those other things going on there. So you've got to be careful.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, absolutely. Fair point. Yeah.
So you mentioned labour force. You guys bring labour in from the continent, and you're talking about mechanisation becoming more efficient with less labour inputs. We've had a lot of changes in terms of where we source labour from. Europe used to be a big source for it. With Brexit, that sort of became a little bit more difficult. What's going on with that?
I suppose historically, if we go kind of back to pre-Brexit, very kind of standard operation for not only kind of viticulture, but also kind of most sort of fruit farming, particularly kind of in the south. Most kind of companies or farms would employ or kind of contract a supplier of labour. Post-Brexit, that's changed quite significantly. There's kind of much more kind of heavier hoops, I suppose, for individuals to jump through in order to come and work here. Vineworks' labour, historically, always been from Romania. They are an incredible kind of bunch of guys and girls that know vines kind of inside and out. And we've noticed that the numbers have really started to drop post-Brexit, almost in half. But we've retained really a kind of a core group of guys that have worked with us for kind of in excess of 10 years. So we've got an incredible amount of experience, efficiency kind of within our labour force. Because obviously getting that kind of labour availability is a lot more sort of tricky. We've seen lots of estates, producers start to mix it up, I suppose, to use more local teams and kind of blend that in with bringing in outside contract sort of labour to support that, really. And that's something I think we've seen producers like Raffini particularly, you know, kind of using, you know, or kind of...
They're basically using their supporters. It's more like come and have a glass of wine and work in a vineyard for an experience, isn't it?
We've seen a marked move to actual paid, not just people looking for an experience. We're talking about kind of larger vineyards with a pool of people, locals, you know, maybe semi-retired or looking for that type of work. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've made a kind of a marked shift towards that, really. And help support by, you know, kind of labour crews from companies like Vineworks, like us, really.
Okay.
Amongst our sort of smaller clients as well, we've been asked to train kind of local teams sort of for them, really. So where we've set up a smaller vineyard, you know, they're not going to use our kind of in-house labour, but they've got a group of locals or kind of are able to recruit a few local staff, and they'll use our kind of expertise and advice to help sort of upskill those on a kind of routinely basis, really. Yep. So it's kind of changed. It's really changed where it was kind of easy to recruit migrant labour. Now that's moved to much more kind of a hybrid model.
Yep.
And that's purely down to what's happened with Brexit.
Has that driven up the price that you pay people?
We pay above minimum wage ourselves. Mm-hmm. The government have consecutively increased the minimum wage by several times over several years. So naturally, the labour cost, whether that's domestic in-house labour or whether that's labour that's recruited from elsewhere, the cost of that labour has increased significantly.
Yeah.
In the past sort of 5 years, really.
We talked about driverless tractors. What areas of the viticultural process do you think is ripe for increased mechanisation or delabouring, if you like? Which areas do you see that coming from?
In the past few years, particularly in the UK, I mean, these activities are probably a bit more prevalent in established regions like New Zealand. Pre-pruning, for one. So labour's...
Winter pruning, or...?
Pruning labour is one of your biggest costs
outside of
harvest. And it's incredibly labour intensive to prune a vine. Anything that you can do to help speed that up kind of helps reduce that cost. Obviously, we don't have robots or anything that can expertly prune a double Guillot vine, leaving, you know, two expertly positioned canes and two spurs. What you can do to help alleviate that is running through with effectively a barrel pruner and taking some of the prunings off the top of the trellis.
Yep.
And this helps to speed up the pulling out. So once the guys have made the cuts, they've chosen the canes and the spurs, the next job is then to pull out those canes.
That's
if that's much quicker, it speeds things up by, you know, 20-30% at least, really.
Okay.
And the other activity related to sort of pruning is called cane rippers or cane pullers. And again, these are kind of much more prevalent in New Zealand. One of the kind of foremost producers of this type of kit is a New Zealand-based company. You send through guys that make the cuts and the canes, trims, and then this machine goes through and just pulls the canes sort of post-pruning.
How does it know not to rip out the ones that weren't pruned?
Well, you've made all your cuts and everything is all separate from what's left, really. You're just not pulling out. So this effectively does it for you. So there's machines like that will help and do help speed up that process. Mm-hmm. But everything else is relatively, you know, kind of hands-on and manual. Activities like bud rubbing or water chute removal, wire lifting, and de-leafing to a certain extent can be done by machine. The finish is not as good as it is by hand, really.
Okay.
And we've touched on previously about machine harvesting as well. That's the other. A machine harvested ton of grapes is significantly less in terms of cost than a hand harvested sort of product, really.
Yep. Yep. And have you seen any kit that you thought, wow, this is just about to be released in the next 5 years or so, and this is going to make my life really good?
I've seen things kind of almost like at Tomorrow's World kind of.
Yeah. I did. It was you when we saw that electrocuting the weeds. Was it you I spoke to at the Vineyard show?
Yeah, Rootwave.
Yes, that's
those
right.
Guys. Yeah. I've seen a demo of that. It's a pretty neat bit of kit. The piece of kit I was thinking about was to do with spraying. I think there'll be a lot more. We won't necessarily be spraying chemicals, but there's certainly, you see technology in the pipeline that are looking at other ways of spraying, of combating disease and pests through things like UV and other products.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that later on. I want to talk a bit about disease and controls, so that'd be interesting, like UV light, eh? Okay. I think we'll wrap it up there, Chris.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
No worries.